Hello, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Highland Bullpen. Tonight it's Alan here hosting, and I'm joined by Yorkshire Dave. What we're really doing here is recreating the Boston Red Sox Detroit Tigers rivalry, which I will be witnessing in person in a couple of weeks' time, or actually just over a week's time. So looking forward to that, and we'll be all smiles and friends just now, and no doubt after the game as well, as Dave raises a beer towards me. So the main thing I think we wanted to have a chat about tonight and try to get our heads around and our normal sports knowledge, our normal football knowledge. We've always found the trade deadline and the draft system and such like a little bit different and a little bit harder to understand to maybe what we're used to in European and UK sports. And felt this year was one of the years I started to get my head around the trade deadline a little bit more and what activity takes place, possibly because the Tigers were involved in two of the larger trades, or certainly from my perspective, two big trades, which not really witnessed that much before. And we're certainly not trading up, unfortunately, as we head for another season without anything particularly happening. And although indeed the Tigers did end up with perhaps one of the biggest stories of the trade deadline, and more of that in a wee second. So I think I've mentioned on the podcast recently the Tigers, we've been doing okay pitching wise. Michael Lorenzen and Eduardo Rodriguez done well, and I then started to pick up, but obviously these guys were considered big chips for the run up to the trade deadline, and people would be after them. And I thought, well, why would the Tigers get rid of top quality pitchers when they've got them there? But the Tigers aren't a winning team. The rebuild seems to be going on and on. These two guys are pretty solid in our rotation, but where are we actually going? And then, of course, it comes into the reality of how long a contract do these guys have? Michael Lorenzen's contract was due up at the end of this season. And I think in football terms, we would be calling that pretty much maybe not quite a sackable offence for the director of football, but generally we're now not used to quality players running out their contract. We've seen it happen a few times recently, and it's always disappointing, and it just seems to be, yeah, we've not cashed in our chips. And when I saw that Lorenzen was traded for a prospect, again, you're thinking, how do you get rid of a guy at that quality? And just pulling a prospect. But the Tigers aren't going anywhere. They're not getting promoted into playoffs, if we call it that. And they're not getting relegated into AAA because that just doesn't happen. So the guy can leave, or he can even re-sign for the Tigers in a couple of months' time. So you trade him off now, it'll make no difference. We might finish fourth instead of third. Unfortunately, people don't tend to really care about that. It might put you lower down and you get a higher draft pick going forward. But yeah, he's off. We've got a prospect in, so that's considered good business. I did notice he pitched for the Phillies last night in his debut start. He went pitched eight innings, so impressive stuff. Carries on his good form, and the Tigers all-star will continue in that vein. The other interesting one was Eduardo Rodriguez, considered possibly a more valuable chip to trade with, and the Tigers were very supportive of Erod last year when, for family reasons, he took a bit of time out. Tigers supported him, and he's come back and he's pitched well this year. This is a bizarre story to me, and again, Dave might have some insights, but we're looking to trade him to the Dodgers. It appears his contract had a no trade clause with 10 different teams, of which the Dodgers would be one. So he's put into his contract, his agent's put into his contract, I'm assuming, I'm not going to one of these 10 teams, of which one is the Dodgers. But then the Tigers tried to trade him to the Dodgers. He must have had a reason for putting the Dodgers in there. I presume that's personal reasons. I presume his family want to live in certain places, certain areas, which is all perfectly understanding. These guys are well paid. Yeah, they want a World Series ring. He's got more chance in Los Angeles. But yeah, personal happiness wins over. So a very bizarre story. The Tigers would then try to do that. It doesn't reflect well on the GM. You can suggest that talks must have been progressing all along, but yeah, it's starting to get more of an idea of what's going on here. You're a losing. I never understood that concept, Dave. If you're a losing team, so you're just going to get rid of your good players and make yourself worse. How do you replace these guys? I understand now if you're a winning team, you're going to go all in to get that extra pitcher to make sure you get into the playoffs. And when you get to playoffs, you want to have two or three aces who are going to give you the wins. They're going to take you through to the World Series. So, yeah, interesting times, Dave. You've probably got good perspective on the trade deadline and possibly how that ties into other aspects of building the team as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It totally differs to our sense of what we call transfer activity, you know, when we talk about football. And I think we spoke about it before, possibly last year, you know, and the trade deadline is the 1st of August, just after the All-Star break in MLB. And this is when teams either sell or buy, and that reflects whatever position they're in. If they're a team that is in contention for a playoff spot and maybe a championship or a World Series win, then they will strengthen. They will look to buy in or trade for someone who can make a bit of a difference. If they need an extra pitcher, a relief pitcher, or a positional player, then they'll trade some of their prospects, some of the guys in their farm system, more of that later. So they're trading potential future for success immediately. And then you get the teams who are going to sell. And these are the teams who are not in contention, perhaps, you know, have a losing record. And so they might have one or two really good veteran players on their staff who could make a difference to teams who are in contention. So what they do is they sort of cash in on them, and they'll say, right, well, we'll trade them and we'll get in a couple of prospects. And these will be likely teams who are building for the future, not even next year or the season after. Perhaps typically these days, Boston, find I've seen them described as a tweener team. So they really neither bought or sold this trade deadline, which kind of reflects their position in as much as they're a winning team, but only 6 or 7 games above 500 and currently 3.5 games off a wild card spot. So, and that, you know, from Boston's point of view, they're quite well off for positional players, and they've got Trevor Story coming back soon. What they probably needed was some more starting pitching, because they've had injuries in that in their lineup, in their starting pitching. Traditionally, you have 5 starting pitchers, and they've really been going with 3. And they've got a couple coming back, and sort of equally importantly, there was one guy in the starting lineup, James Paxton, who was talked about as being a target for other teams who are in contention, and it looked like he might be traded, but they kept him. So that was a positive. But to put that back into perspective, it's one thing understanding the rules of the game of baseball and the tactics, but the intricacies of the structure of the game is another. And the trade deadline and the draft happens a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it, around about the All-Star break. And they're starting to build that into how an MLB club builds its team, its roster. You know, they have a 40-man roster. That's the maximum number of guys they can have in their first team, if you like. But they will have a farm system, and that will consist of affiliated clubs at 3 or 4 levels below Major League Baseball. So the next level down is Triple A. The level below that, Double A and Class A. So you will have the young guys. These are clubs. Triple A is a very high standard of baseball. You will have a lot of guys. This is used not just for prospects. This is the final point at which prospects will come in, with the expectation that they'll go to the show next season. But you also have guys who are rehabilitating from injury. So you'll have very strong level of game. Double A, I think that's a decent standard. I would need to check this, but I'm sure I heard somebody call that the slider division. That's the sort of when you're going to, you know, anything below that, you'll probably just get pitchers with one or two pitches, but Double A, you'll start getting sliders.
Right.
And players will have to face a different, you know, a pretty good level of pitching.
Yeah.
So you've got that. That's where the prospects come through. The draft, it takes that 2 days. So you've got 30 clubs who each have 20 picks, is it? So even with my arithmetic, that's 600 players are decided. So each club will take on at the draft an extra 20 guys. And these are guys who range from, you know, sort of high school to college guys. So it's guys aged between sort of 18 and 21, would you say?
So there's obviously 20 guys leaving each team each year as well. Like, you'll get a handful of end of career retirements, injury retirements, I guess, and then young guys that have just decided I'm not going to make it. So
I think there's probably quite a high fallout of players from Class A, you know, and Double A. So, you know, at least 20 new young prospects are added to their farm system.
Tough school, tough farm school, that, isn't it?
It really is. Well, it's a, you know, and you find out with the trade, then you've got the trade deadline, which we've just been talking about. And this is when teams either top up their talent, or it's players who can make an impact, an immediate impact in that season. Sometimes they're bought at a trade deadline to try and get them to the playoffs or to a championship. And if it does, if it works out, or even if it doesn't work out, sometimes, you know, they're traded in the postseason, and they'll only have been there. I think that is that what happens with one of my favourites, Kyle Schwarber, who the Red Sox brought in a couple of years ago, got them to the playoffs. It was brilliant, and then they traded him in the postseason. And then, of course, at the end of the season, the postseason, you have the free agency, and this is when you see really the big money coming out, and big, not in terms of transfer fee, but in terms of contracts offered to the real star players who are coming towards the end of their contracts. And like you say, they will, you know, there'll be guys who have maybe got 1 or 2 years left on their contract, and that's the time when you'll see other clubs stepping in and making a big offer. But it's not a transfer deal like we understand it. So, you know, like if Shohei Ohtani goes as a free agent or in the postseason, I think the biggest deals have been 10 or 15 year deals for 300 and odd million, sort of 30 something million. They're talking about him going for $500 million. So I don't know whether
you could buy every football team in Scotland for that.
It's incredible the amount of money that they're talking about.
Can I ask then, Dave, if it's free agency, that would imply to me that these are guys who are coming out of contract, or will you have a 5-year contract that allows you to go somewhere else at any? I mean, at football, we would be used to people getting transferred during their contract.
Yes.
Does that happen much here? Or do they tend to see out the contract unless they're traded?
I wouldn't pretend to know the real detail of this, because You know, you may have 1 or 2 years left on your contract, but that doesn't mean to say that you can't move, because players will have options and the club have options. So that usually means an option to trade you if certain things in their contract aren't met. And likewise, the player will have options as well. So it usually comes down to pretty much the same in football. If the player wants to go and is not happy with the revised contract is being offered and thinks he can get more elsewhere, then he will. Yeah, I do think that if there's less to go on his contract, so if he's out of contract, then the club who's selling him or trading him on, less likely to get anything in return. But if he's got a year or two left on his contract, then, certainly this is the case for Shohei Ohtani. If he's got a few years left on his contract, anyone taking on his contract, a new contract, would have to also offer his holding club numerous serious prospects as part of the deal.
And it tends to be, I know you mentioned before, like cash considerations, but it tends to more be the offering of prospects, or indeed, the one thing that's always baffled me, but it's not actually baffling, is when they say, as part of the deal, we are now getting the Phillies' fourth round pick in
Yeah.
next year's draft. And you sort of think, well, that's a bit weird. But what you're effectively saying is, well, we know at that standard, there's probably a decent guy in there that we're gonna get into our farm system and see how he goes.
Yeah, there are specific rules about it, but you just you'd have to be a professional baseball pundit to really know all that. It's tough enough for us to keep track of our team because they play every day. We've got to keep track of what's happening for our own team and a little bit beyond that. But to understand really the complex nature of football, something we've grown up with, we'll know quite a bit more about the history of how transfer deals are done. But really, do we know? The Athletic does some great in-depth articles about that, so you find out more and more. But I just gonna have to click onto these MLB glossary pages about trade. You click onto one of them about trade deadlines,
Because the
and
interesting thing,
they're all there, but.
So one of the interesting things here as well, of course, is that you're actually trading with a rival. Now, it might not be your closest rival, but you're trading effectively with people in the same competition. And that is relatively unusual in football, especially these days. People seem to move more internationally, or young prospects are moving up leagues, up divisions. So it's here you're actually thinking, and that's why teams who are not interested in winning or don't have an expectation of winning, you're quite comfortable trading with the Dodgers or whoever, because they're in the same competition, but you're not really in the same competition.
There's not the same jeopardy, is there? So from our point of view, football, Scottish Premier Division or the English Premier Division, if you find yourself in a losing season and you're towards the bottom of the league, the basement, as they would call it, then you have a very real prospect of being relegated to the division below, and that has massive financial implications, apart from status of the club. So what a team will do is they will probably change the manager and spend money and buy players to try and protect their position, which is the opposite of what they do in baseball. What they do in baseball is say, well, yeah, we're not going to win this year. we've lost. We've got these two guys who are good, and they're not going to do anything for us, but they may help another team. And the other, you know, another team like the Yankees or the Dodgers may come in and say, yeah, well, you know, look at the Astros. They've just got back Verlander from the Mets.
Back. Yeah.
You know, they will think, well, it's no skin off our nose because we'll get some prospects in and we'll start building again for the future. Whereas someone like the Astros say, well, this is the guy we need to, you know, to get us the back-to-back World Series that they crave for. I think they might do it as well. I mean, it was a brilliant move and got Altuve back from one or two players. But, you know, I think we'll see them take off again. But yeah, it's totally different.
Yeah,
it also, there's no relegation, there's no jeopardy.
Yeah. It also makes, if you were maybe one time in a future, a soon to come episode, we can start predicting playoffs and World Series entrance. But the trade also makes, we have the January transfer window. And I guess it's a similar concept there because you might then reassess how a team are going to do, depending on who they've taken in, but particularly so in Major League Baseball. So I'm going to ask you another question, Dave, and get your opinion on this one as well. You mentioned Justin Verlander there. Until a few days ago was the last Astros player to throw a no-hitter. And then is it Framber Valdez turned up and did the same thing? If I'm not mistaken, the last no hitter in the Major League Baseball before that was the good old Detroit Tigers. and of course, that was a combined no hitter. So a no hitter, you get 27 strikeouts, haven't you? There's no hits. Nobody reaches base through a hit. So there have only been 20 combined no hitters in Major League Baseball. Where I don't know how many individual no-hitters that have been. Now, it's a much more significant event to do an individual no-hitter because you're relying on your starting pitcher to do the handed pitches or whatever and be the one who gets it all out. Obviously, a manager manages his team well and he possibly doesn't pull many guys who are on a no-hitter out. He lets them go as far as they can, but Hinch decided not to for the Tigers. So I get that one is a more exciting achievement. But I thought there was quite a lot of people poo-pooing the Tigers no-hitter. And I just wondered if you had any perspective on, some people are saying they don't even count it as a no-hitter, but come on, guys, give us some excitement in Detroit. I don't know if you have any perspective on that.
Yeah, it does seem a bit churlish. Not too real.
Thank you.
It's, you know, it probably was unusual. Because, you know, back in the early days of baseball, it would be more usual for starting pitchers to throw a complete game. You know, that would be the norm, that, you know, one pitcher would pitch the whole game. So when you had a no-hitter, it would be credited to the starting pitcher. And then... I don't know why this sort of combined no-hitters seem to be less favoured. There's nothing wrong with it. I saw the Valdez one for the Houston Astros. They were excited because it was the first time in the franchise history that a left-handed pitcher had had a no-hitter. So there might be something in that, in as much as lefties, what's the rule? Batters are opposite pitcher name. So really, right-handed pitchers, I think right-handed batters, would there be more right-handed batters than lefties? So,
That's a big thing when you say that. Yeah, I mean, you've outlined some of the reasons why. To me, it must be easier to get a combined no-hitter, hence why you might play it down a little bit. But with there only being 20 in the major leagues, it, it It shows you how unique an experience it actually is. And I'm going to put this one down to good management by AJ Hinch. And let's if other teams want to keep their pitcher in there until he loses a hit, then let them go. Let them go.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there was something else earlier this season, wasn't there? There was a perfect game.
Yeah.
So Domingo German or Herman of the New York Yankees. And that's slightly different to a no-hitter. That is definitely 27 batters up and 27 given out. So
no walks.
With a no-hitter, you could get guys getting on base for a variety of different reasons, you know, hit by pitch or walk or pass ball, something like that. I mean, you can even, there has been instances where there's been no hitters and the team has lost. I'm pretty sure that is a possibility, but these perfect games, they're very rare. There's only been 24 in the entire history of the game, and the Yankees, unsurprisingly, have four of them. I do remember this happening. It happened a couple of times. You know, I think I've mentioned this before. When I was first really got very interested in baseball was when it was televised live on Channel 5 in sort of 97, 98, 99, and there was two perfect games in 98 and 99 for the Yankees, David Wells and David Cohn. And then there's that very famous one in a World Series, the Don Larsen 1956 versus the Dodgers. And if anyone is watching the games live on MLB TV, they have in the commercial break, they have weave in little stories, and they've got Yogi Berra in quite a few of these stories, and he was in that team, that 1956 team, and the person who's telling the story said this is how it would have done it. He would have described it. It ain't been done before, and it ain't been done since. And you know, to see a perfect game must be, something else.
Yeah, great stories there, Dave, and good to draw the Yogi Berra as well. Always have a smile on my face when his name is mentioned as well. So, anyway, this time next week I'll be somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean, heading to Boston, looking to keep up the Highland Bullpen's record of 0-8 at Fenway Park, and going to see the Red Sox twice. So hopefully get that record to 0-10, if that's acceptable to yourself, when the Tigers come a-calling. Looking forward to that. Take a chance to tick off. That'll be my seventh Major League ballpark. Doing the stadium tour before one of the games as well. I've only done the stadium tour of the Mariners before. So this one I'm doing the pre-game tour, so that might add some extra value into it. And I'll go and see the Green Monster and check out the seats you were sat in yourself this season.
Yeah, it's a really good tour. We got a guy who was absolutely fantastic. It couldn't have been any better. I think it's going from memory. I think his name was George, and it was probably a retired gentleman like myself, and what a fantastic stories he had to tell.
Yeah.
You know, go back to, I won't spoil it for you, 1912, but he'll tell you about the opening game, and I was very pleased with the team that Boston beat that day.
I can only imagine.
But yeah, you get a fantastic tour around, the Green Monster seats and all around the pavilion area. So I've forgotten where are your seats for. You're going to two games, aren't you? You've got different sort of.
Yeah, I think pretty sure one of the games I'm not too far, well, behind home plate, and I think one of them, I think I'm at first, well, not quite at first base, but a wee bit further over for catching a decent foul ball. If a ball comes anywhere near me, I think I'll be getting myself out of the way. I'm not going to have that stinging my hands.
Yeah, I think you have to pay attention. But I think there's a lot more netting than there used to be. I think
Right.
the nets really used to be just more or less behind the space,
Yeah. I
behind
presume
banks.
going to the pre-game tour gives you a chance you're going to see batting practice and the bars there will be a wee bit quieter, so you get easy to get yourself a pint
Yeah,
to take it all in.
My advice for for any game that you go into, if it's just a one-off, or even if okay, is get there early,
Yeah.
and I think actually I wouldn't say we made an error, but we had seats for the Green Monster, and I didn't realize, but I think if you've got Green Monster seats, that entitles you to get in to batting practice, which is, I think you can go. I think the stadium opens to the general public with seats an hour and a half before the game, but batting practice takes place just a bit before then. And to get in there, you've either got to be a member
Right.
or have some special seats. But we had our own special seat. I was told you about in the bleachers bar, which incredibly, I didn't realize, it basically forms part of the stadium. And there is a window, a grilled window, which is, I think it's just slightly beyond the Green Monster. So you can, if you're watching a game, look for the Green Monster, and then just beyond there, in left field, in the corner there, you'll see a grilled window, perhaps one or two people, and that's the bar. You can, and
Yeah.
you don't, you, you know, if you just get there early enough, you'll get in, and you can sit there or stand there and
Watch
watch
again.
the
Brilliant.
game.
No, looking forward to that. So, yeah, whether we see any no hitters or anything. So just I mean, there's always something new happening in baseball. And the Cubs. So I mean, we can mention this because. White Sox Dave isn't around just now, but so the Cubs went on a bit of a scoring frenzy this week, and it was the most runs they've scored in two consecutive games. I think it was since 1900, and
Really?
it was also the first time ever that any team has had 10 extra base hits and 5 home runs in two consecutive games. Now, I know you can make the numbers up, but that's obviously the highest numbers of those two combined that's been achieved, and that's pretty phenomenal stuff. I think they scored 36 in two games, so those games obviously aren't going to be the 2-hour 40 games, and the pitchers obviously struggling somewhere in there as well. But it never fails to fascinate me how there's always something new and unusual happening there.
Isn't there? I'm just trying to remember because obviously we saw them play at MLB London earlier, didn't they? And it was a split series when it Cubs and the Cardinals. Cubs did win the first game. I think they scored a few runs as well, but the Cards came. Am I remembering that correctly? It was only a few weeks ago, but yeah, a lot has happened since.
Yeah, so no, it was so trying then to think of football wise, it just doesn't happen. I see Comerica Park hosted Crystal Palace of the Premier League, English Premiership, the other week. They're playing Sevilla. Drew, well, I think it was at the weekend, drew 1-1. So the best stats I can come up with that was that they went to a penalty shootout because they can't have a draw, obviously. That just would be a pointless exercise. And the same thing happened in the first soccer game at Comerica Park, which was PSG and Roma. So the best start I'm going to come up with, and Richard might appreciate it as a Celtic man, is Odson Edward, who played for Celtic for a wee bit. He has now played in two games at Comerica Park, because he played for PSG in the first one, and then he played for Crystal Palace in this one. So it's a fairly meaningless stat, but it's the sort of thing that might keep us football lovers a wee bit happy. And I see you saw your hometown team in one of your adopted hometowns at the weekend as well, Dave.
Yeah, it was a trip down memory lane for this young Leeds lad who left Leeds in 1981 to go and live and work in the great city of Edinburgh. And yeah, it was sort of, yeah, by the time I got my own place there, it was sort of at the end of 1981. So 82 was really my first year there. And Leeds United played a pre-season friendly. That was the first time against Hearts, and that was the first time I went to Tyne Castle. Right. And they also played the following season, 1983. But it's been 40 years later. We played there last Sunday, and we do sort of still go up there. My wife's family still live in Edinburgh, and we go up quite regularly to stay with my mother-in-law, and they're all Dundee fans, of course, my in-laws. But yeah, so I went along and had a fantastic time, really enjoyed it. I went up to the game on my own. The brother-in-law's a Dundee fan, the other brother-in-law's a Hearts fan. They couldn't make it to the game, but I met them afterwards for a few pints in the Roseburn bar. You'll probably know it, sort of Murrayfield area. I went to the famous Diggers beforehand, the Athletic Arms, which is so called because it's opposite the churchyard, the Grave Diggers Arms, I think it's.
Okay, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, it's a long time since I've been to Tyne Castle. I don't think I've been in since they've completely redeveloped it into that old seater stadium. It's quite impressive, actually. And there was a good crowd there. And it wasn't a bad game for pre-season, but I think Leeds did quite well, actually. Although, how they will transform that into playing the Championship, time will tell.
Well, here's to them getting out a lot quicker than the last time as well. So, yeah, I had a wee trip through to Edinburgh. That was last week as well. My local team, as they were, Ross County, were playing Edinburgh City in the group stages of the League Cup. But Edinburgh City now play in Meadowbank Stadium, which was the old Commonwealth Games Stadium of the 1970s. Yeah. And it's been converted. The seating area now consists of three rows of seats. And then you look out over the running track onto an artificial surface. It wasn't the glory days, I guess, at Meadowbank Stadium would once have been, but it was probably, I reckon, 40-odd years since I've been there as well. I think Nairn County played there in a Scottish Cup tie many years ago. So it's always good to revisit past haunts like that, and Scottish football has the ability to throw those sort of things up at us.
I've been a couple of times to the Meadowbank Stadium, but I can't claim it as a football. Yeah, could I include it in ground hopping? It was actually to see an athletics event on both occasions.
Right.
A gig, I think, actually.
My rule tends to be for footballogy, if it's a sporting event taking place in the stadium, then you're good with that. I think if that's the rule amongst friends, we can live with that. I'm sure there'll be somewhere else that disagree, but
Meadowbank Thistle, isn't it?
That's right. It was Meadowbank Thistle who were Ferranti Thistle, became Meadowbank Thistle, and now Livingston playing in the Premiership. So it's not done them any harm leaving there as well. And transportation is so much easier these days as well. I hadn't been on a bus in Edinburgh for years. I jumped on the bus and I told the guy a single to Meadowbank, and he just sort of looked at me and said, "It's a flat fare wherever you go." So, and you just tap on and tap off with your, well, you don't even tap off, you tap on with your credit
I would have
cards.
just said that single to the terminus then. I'm
I
gonna
want to
stay
get
on all
my
day.
money's worth. Yeah, so I know it's good to do that. So a wee bit of help for tourists as well. Big, I know a lot of our listeners, international listeners, may fancy trips to Edinburgh sometimes. So it's good to see that we make that type of experience more interesting. And if you're ever going to Edinburgh, then I think the two of us might be able to give you a little bit of advice on some watering holes. You might enjoy there. And I met one of my friends who you know at the game last week, Gibby. And whenever I bump into him, we always reminisce about my stag do or bachelor party down Rose Street, which, that's for another podcast, folks. But we hope you've enjoyed our random chats, and we hope we've helped you understand a wee bit more about the trade deadline and the draft day, the draft and what have you, and how teams build up their teams. So until the next time, we'll catch you again on the Highland Bullpen.